And one of those right now is David Terachuk with the Media Beat. David, of course, joins us every Friday here on Robin Hood Radio. He has his own website, themediabeat.us. You can find him there. You can also find him, of course, as a PBS television correspondent. You can find him right here on Robin Hood Radio. And today, in a special treat, he's getting on the boards. Good morning, David. How are you?
Good morning. Yes, I'm back with you, reporting in from the media capital of the world, New York City, the home, I should say, of that renowned legal expert, Rudolph Giuliani, who used to be our mayor and, of course, was dubbed America's mayor at the time. But yes, it's the home of Broadway as well, too. And I consider media to, embrace, for the Media Beat at least, my weekly column and my weekly appearance with you, to embrace all forms of media. And I think Broadway theater is a very, very incisive form of all the... You're going to have to excuse me because I also have a very bad cold this week. Broadway theater and theater of all kinds is an incisive form when it comes to the various media of expression. What should we talk about?
We should talk about the great... Here's what we should talk about for one quick second because of theater. The different, how it remains the one, I should say one, it's one of the main platforms left, speaking of media platforms, where you actually have to put down your device and use multiple senses to get what's going on.
Oh, isn't that good? Yes.
Yeah, no,
very clear insistence every time. Turn off your telephones and, not just silence them because, in the so-called silence of a Broadway play, often just the simple buzzing of a muted phone can be extremely distracting.
But also those funny, that weird light that goes with it. Other words, because the show is actually on the stage, and it just, at this juncture where people are so, I'm really fascinated just by the, let's call it the information overload. Probably one of the happiest things I read this morning was from Mikey Allen on his Axios AM saying, "Happy Friday note from Mike. After 480 straight Axios AMs, I'm off the grid in Maine catching fish and clearing my mind."
Ah, what a good, sensible thing to do.
You know what I mean?
Sure. I'm not much of a fisherman, but I'll go catch a whopper in the theater any evening. I went to see Travesty's, an extraordinary play, dates back quite a long way, but it's constantly being revived, and this latest revival is well worth attention. And one of the great things about going to the theatre is it's just like the fishing trip. It's a wonderful antidote to over-concentration on screens, small, medium-sized, and large. I'm a huge fan of theatre, and I love reviewing it for the Media Beat. And as you know, I was doing it when I was in London lately, an interesting play there, all about the decision-making, the very tough decision-making that went into sending the troops into northern France for D-Day, and how dependent that was on an accurate and reliable weather forecast. Funny that the Brits should come up with a play about the weather. Actually, one of the lines in the play is, "Well, you know, we Brits, the weather, it's all we ever talk about." But they went a long way from being a stock national caricature and produced a very fine consideration of what happens when so many lives can hang on a decision-making process, in this case, a decision to be made by General Dwight D. Eisenhower, the Allied commander for the Allies. And he was getting contrary weather predictions. And one said it was okay to invade, one said it could possibly be disastrous. And not a generally well-known fact is that D-Day was actually postponed a day because of that, finally.
It's not a generally well-known fact. There's another wonderful, not a generally well-known fact, which was not quite weather-related, but not dissimilar, which was basically the entire operation was Double Cross, and the specific one was Mincemeat, where you know, there's this wonderful use of information deception distortion. And
yes, something we need to be paying a lot of attention to.
A lot of attention, because the fact is, you know, false flags, people really need to sort of have that contextual background to appreciate a bigger picture of what's actually going on and what they're being told and how their minds are being diverted to a certain channel of and I'm going to use this overused word, narrative. But the great thing about, as with the weather and those little known facts, it's if you're not aware of those basics, it's literally history can turn on it. Back to you.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. Well, the history's been turning out. Excuse me. The history that's been turning out over the last few days from. Concerning, as so often, this extraordinary White House of ours, bracketed by the New York Times getting a leak, you know, that famous tool in the information and disinformation business, a leak of the questions which Prosecutor Mueller evidently plans to confront the president with, if he ever gets a chance, one-on-one, mano a mano, coming through to the end of the week when our ex-mayor, Rudolph Giuliani, who is a lawyer by trade, is apparently, and anxious to practice again with a very particular client, he's now the personal lawyer to the president, Donald J. Trump, and he went on television with that that other player in the action, Hannity of Fox News, and ends up contradicting every piece of defense that's been used so far in the matter of Stormy Daniels and her claim that she had a short affair with the president, and the claims of the White House until now that Mr. Trump knew nothing about, and Mr. Trump himself said, I knew nothing about the payment of $130,000 for Stormy Daniels' silence. That got well and truly torpedoed by the legal genius, Rudolph Giuliani, on Sean Hannity's TV program, so much that it was interesting to see Sean Hannity trying to do some insistent questioning and giving Rudolph Giuliani several chances to roll his contentious notion back. But no, he stuck to it. And now, of course, the president and his cohorts are trying to fold it into, as you say, a narrative, which now makes rather different sense
this
from before.
This is going to make such a great play.
It will. It will make a fun. I know just the writer for it. The clever. Clever, Tom Stoppard. He's more than clever. As Travis is this week and on the Broadway production that just started last week, shows. I mean, there's a playwright who gets all that kind of cleverness through and invests it with an enormous sense of humanity, human pain, and human joy.
And you know, he's
an extraordinary playwright.
And he will be the hard problem. At Lincoln Center this fall.
Uh-huh.
A stopper.
That's right.
The hard problem. So, assuming that all goes as planned. So, it should do. But the point is that people would, and this goes back, they would do well to, it sounds so trite, but expose themselves. I was going to say educate, but I'm now going to say expose themselves to different non-screen experiences to better incorporate and better experience the screen experience. Because, again,
everything you draw in from other kinds of media will increase your acuity for perceiving and appreciating what comes to you in another. I mean, that's one of the essentials of creativity. I think the painter who doesn't read is going to be a less good painter than a painter who does read.
Right, and the reader that doesn't, you know, it is absolutely true. And yet this veers into the philosophical realm, but you've got a cold, so I might as well ask you anyway. Because
I get very philosophical when I have a cold, yeah.
A lot of people do. All right. Presuming that the media has always been designed, it's an ad-based, it is a commercial enterprise. So
In many societies, it's probably fair to say most societies, yes, that's true. Advertising is its lifeblood.
Yeah. All right. So with that, it is really far more interesting to read about something horrible than it is to read about something peaceful. So
it seems. Human nature loves to see trouble. It is drawn to the depiction of trouble and difficulty and horror sometimes too. We know that, yeah.
Right? So
and they much abused. Little adage, but it does remain true in terms of, you know, what is custom and practice, certainly in tabloid journalism. If it bleeds, it leads.
Right.
So let's acknowledge that too.
Okay.
Yes.
So
ahead.
But the bleed lead, found a if it bleeds, it leads. Found a perfect match. I mean, what a romance with all this screen stuff. So to catch up, you know, the drier, more factual, the heavy lifting of reading is sort of not as, you know, it's not as thrilling. It's reduced to a headline. We're all so fast, and who knows whether the headline's right or not. Blah 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 blah, and it's relentless and unremitting. So. In its own funny way, what I'm trying to figure out, because I'm thinking about sort of the utopian, clean information, which is really hard to get. And I find myself personally constantly fooled, because when I start thinking that's the purpose, I get really frustrated. Like, why aren't you doing this? Why aren't you doing this? And then I realize, wait a second, wait. And this is the philosophical
question.
Well,
you're bound to be disappointed if you think that the media's purpose is to remain clean
and deliver
only clean information.
And that's the philosophical that's the philosophical rub that I wanted to get into. It's like, it isn't. So why pretend?
Well, because it remains. I mean, this is another aspect of human behavior in general, not just media. It remains helpful. It is a professional consensus for us, and I think a general sort of, I guess, you know, Western liberal values, liberal with a small L, that is, suggest that. There is a consensus that it's good to have an ideal, and the ideal may not be lived up to every minute of the day, but it's good to have an ideal. And the ideal is that the media deal in provable and truthful facts. Well, we know that that's not generally true, but it doesn't stop people, you know, innocents and naive people like me, practitioners in the trade. It doesn't prevent us from trying to hold to that ideal, nonetheless. You know, however,
well,
abused it is in custom and practice.
It messes with my mind, and one of the things that I found frustrating, just in terms of my idealism, is if you watched at the same time, I think it was this day, yeah, I think it was this morning, two completely different cable news outlets. It's not just that the stories were different. It's that the slant was so complete. Anybody watching one is got a completely... They're not going to be able to speak to the people watching the other because the gap is...
Well, they'll be speaking about something very different and probably speaking about it in a very different language.
Right, using similar words, and that's where... And this goes back to my forgetting any idealistic tendencies I might have about facts. This goes back to tolerance and my childhood, where my mother really insisted that her kids understand that there was a big wide world out there full of all sorts of different types of people. And as I now become my grandmother's age, I'm incredibly grateful to her for doing that. But there's a terrific story out of Chicago, local story right now, where the Deputy Consul General of Israel was thrown out of, on Thursday night, was thrown out of his Uber because he was speaking Hebrew into his cell phone.
The Uber driver, I suppose, had some exception to that. Right?
That's right. No, it doesn't speak of that. That's exactly right. And I don't know who the Uber driver was.
Not a lot of tolerance training given to Uber drivers, I suspect. But I could be wrong. They're trying to clean their act up.
With a company name of Uber, why would they throw anybody up? What language? Come on.
Yeah. Speaking of stormtroopers, apropos right, stormtroopers.
You got to be kidding me.
Uber Alles, indeed. Yes. Oh, yeah. I hadn't even thought of that.
Uber Alles. Yeah. Deutschland, Uber. But the point being that none of this engenders tolerance. None of it. And
sure. And yet the fact remains that everyone's going to have to live in a world where opinions are different from their own. As we've discussed again and again, and people right up to the previous President Obama talked about our echo chambers and our bubbles. That we one of the features of this self-selecting form of media consumption now, when we, the consumer, seem to be confronted with the multiplicity of choices that have never been available to people before. But what we end up doing is choosing, and choosing stuff that we already are predisposed to be interested in, approve of, like, and that results in an atmosphere in which we can comfort ourselves. I suppose it's a form of comfort that everything that we're consuming is confirming what we already know, and that runs contrary entirely to the notion of tolerance and taking in the views of other people who are different from us and who have different views entirely.
Yeah, and I don't see again where that is incredibly helpful. But I would say
it makes for a hard world. But I mean, it is a hard world, and our job as consumers is to make sure that we don't insulate ourselves off. But it is also our job, a different hour here, the professionals here. It's our job to make sure that people do get attracted to other things besides the things that they think they already know. And are already in agreement with.
And
it's kind of like when you're in high school. When I was in high school, to get you to experience the academic side to its fullest extent, the high school provided things that that made you happy there, and that connected everything together. Whether it was theater, whether it was sports, whether it was music, whether it was extracurricular activities, there was always something that could link you that you really enjoyed, that you said to yourself, well, I will do the rest of this stuff to do this. That's what the media needs to do now as a whole. They need to bring people in, suck them in, and so to get what they want, they have to experience something else. I mean,
it's questionable, to take us right back to the beginning of Jill's subject, is that it's questionable whether the main tool for the media now, or at least the predominant tool, I should say, is the screen. The screen in the hands or on the lap of an individual screen, delivering this individually chosen messaging out of a whole lot of flow of information directed at us, the consumers, which are already assessing us from the basis of our existing likes and interests. Sure, that's exactly what needs to happen, but I'm not sure that the tools that have been developed so manically over the last 15, 20 years are the tools in which we can... they're not naturally tools that will encourage that kind of tolerance and open-mindedness.
Well, here's the interesting thing. The Region 1... I'm, once again, in my own opinion, against the Region 1 budget. And people that have joined me in this effort are people who politically are 180 degrees away from me. But by presenting my views as open as possible, there's a coalition of people that have joined together. Whether or not we succeed or not isn't the question here. But it's great to see a coalition of people who otherwise politically are so different.
They don't give a rap about it. And what is so interesting.
It's working together.
But that's, you know, that's, A, that's what your grandmother always did. B, it's the way it actually, it's the only way it can, our democratic system, it's the only way it can work. Because otherwise you just have, it's not totalitarian per se, but I'm just saying
it's possible. It's a lot easier though.
Creating strange bedfellows is an art, and it's perfectly achievable. It's just that the cards are stacked against it pretty well in the current media landscape, don't you think?
You're absolutely right.
That's the sad thing. It can be done in a small area.
But that's my point.
Small area. But you know what? The big guys and gals can learn from it.
But the other thing is, how do you get or can you get? And that's the philosophical question. And we're going to end up right smack in the middle of it. But can you get something that's advertising based back to, or at least a little towards, something that engenders more tolerance, or by virtue of, you know, keeping it going because you got to make that money, you stick with your audience?
Well, advertising-based communication funded by, you know, on a graded system, graded by the number of eyeballs that are attracted, is probably not going to be the best format for encouraging the accommodation of contrary views amongst a disparate audience. I think that's probably undeniable. We are going to have to look to other models, and maybe the subscription model, maybe the idea of foundation-based media outlets. We're going to have to think differently from the way we've thought so far about communication in a capitalist society. Mm-hmm.
Thank you very much, David Tereshchuk, The Media Beat.
Thank you.
Better.